1, 2, 3, 4. Linda, I'm talking to George McKinney, technical director of Unto These Hills, Cherokee, North Carolina, July 14th, 1966. George, you might speak just to say hello before I ask any questions and make sure that we're all coming through on this tape.
Okay, hi, Mark.
Fine, I see the level peaks all right. Linda, I think you can pick us up from this level all right. George, as I was saying earlier, we are interested in identifying some of the particular problems of outdoor drama as differentiated from the general techniques of indoor theater staging. Now, I know that some of the problems you have are particular because of this locale. Some of the others are probably general to the field. And I would like to give us a general start without being too specific by asking you first, what do you believe to be the advantages of production out of doors in such a case as Under These Hills? What are the strong points in terms of not only working on the show, but that you feel in terms of audience response or participation?
Well, I don't know that I suppose the size, the scope of a setting is the perhaps the greatest advantage of an outdoor production, where all of our stages are larger than you'd find in most of your indoor theaters. We are able to simulate a natural terrain a lot easier, of course, outdoors than we can indoors. In fact, we rely quite heavily upon that here at Cherokee.
Does this business of the increased space, does this allow you a greater scope, let's say, for scene changing? And you have many different scenes in this play. Does the fact that you have unlimited offstage space help you, or is this space limited because it isn't prepared?
It's quite an asset to our particular show here anyway, because we do have, quite often in your indoor productions, you do have limited wing space and storage space, but in an outdoor production you do have a lot more, and we utilize it quite efficiently and take advantage of it.
George, while we're on this topic of space, which I suppose will lead us into the next thing, that is, what is some of the disadvantages of outdoor drama? Does this increased space in terms of having to play on two side stages and a rather large main stage, and for one person to get from one place around to the other, let's say from the left side stage to the right side stage, is practically a 10-mile hike. Does this make scene shifting and the shifting of the cast more difficult than it would indoors, or is it something that you just organize and handle?
I think it makes it easier. It's quite similar to your Shakespearean type production, where the action flows from one area, one stage to another, and it does allow us to change scenery on a side stage when the action is taking place on a large center stage, or vice versa. And I don't recall any time when an actor has too much difficulty in getting from one stage to another, just at a moderate pace. I mean, no one has to run, make a beeline from one area to another. So I think it works out almost ideal as far as scene shifting to have the three different areas, three different stages, and let the action flow, and consequently we can make the scene changes accordingly.
George, this business of space, does it affect, now I'm speaking now of the space in terms of the way the stage curves around the forward elements of the audience, that is, the left and right side stages swinging a little forward of the main stage, and then of the distance from the various stages to the very back of the theater, or even to the mass of the audience in the theater. Do you find that technically that things must be simplified, or must they be enlarged? Do you depart from reality in any particular way, other than for the style of the scenery piece? Well, are there any adjustments, in other words, that you need to make technically in terms of the scenery or the scene shifting equipment or the placement because of this tremendous distance to the 3,000 people in that auditorium?
Well, on stage, indoor, we to make a sitting projectile, we have to enlarge, eliminate details, and so forth. All we do in outdoor theater is just carry this a little further, a step further. Details are lost on the back row of a 3,000-seat theater, so you pick out the main elements and do away with all the minute detail that just doesn't carry. And we have found out that even though the side stages are not appreciably closer to the audience than the large center stage, maybe 20 feet closer, that that they are a lot more intimate. Maybe perhaps the distance isn't the important factor here, but maybe just because they are smaller and the scenes that are played there are in their own nature a little more intimate, but it's a lot easier to be intimate on a side stage than it is on a large center stage, it seems, in outdoor theater.
George, let's talk a little bit about the disadvantages or special problems that are created. Now, obviously, some disadvantage will occur from the simple fact that you are outside, and not from anything inherent in theater design, but simply because you're outside. Now, I speak of what provisions or adjustments that you need to make in terms of weather protection in the construction or weather protection in the handling and storage of your scenery and possibly of your lighting equipment. I assume that both are factors.
Outdoor productions have, you're battling humidity elements all the time, and of course your conventional scene paint that we use in indoor theater is just can't be used here, so we have to use a waterproof type of scene paint. Originally, we used a casein glue and made our paint from that rather than using the carpenter's ground glue. In the last few years, we've switched over completely to oil-based paint, or just regular house paint in a lot of cases, and it seems to work very well, and you can get almost any color that you desire by blending yourself or what have you. The other problem, of course, is how to treat wood. We are very concerned about that in the mountain area because of the humidity and wood rotting. So all of our lumber wood that we use in theater that is not covered with paint, we have to use a wood protector, creosote, or some preservative of this sort to keep it from rotting, decaying.
Do you have particular problems, George, when, as occurred last night, you got a rain in the middle of the show when costumes and scenery and lighting equipment are all as unprotected as they ever are? Do you have any rain procedures that you follow through, or have you taken care of this in the construction pretty much?
Everything except in the intimate White House scene. We do have quite a bit of drapery material. The chairs, of course, are upholstered, and the drapes at the window. So last night, when it started raining, in scene 8, which was the first White House scene, when we changed it to the second White House scene, we kept the chairs and the draperies, the cornices, in the scene dock, so they didn't get wet. That is about the only thing that we are really concerned about, getting wet. Everything else is waterproof. All of our scene 1 scenery, imitation Indian huts and so forth, are made of elastic, which of course is waterproof. So we don't really worry about anything getting wet anymore, except the chairs and draperies.
And of course, I would include the costumes, although I assume that's not your department.
No, thank goodness.
I wonder, George, in terms of the young people that to come to you that you and Harry hire to handle technical work on the show. First, are you in a position where you have to use people who are selected first as actors? That's the first question. The second part of the question is, do you find qualified technical people to assist you who are either in or just out of the colleges?
We have about 20 technical assistants, we call them, that are directly involved in shifting of scenery, of course, in the pre-show preparation of play of the production every year. About 20 of them, and all of them are hired first as actors, and then they are hired secondly as technicians. They augment their basic actors pay by working as technicians. Of this 20, I would say five of them have a technical bend in their makeup, have some quite a bit of technical experience. And of these five, I'd say two of them are what you might consider really good theater technicians. Rest of them, you have to, they're actors primarily, and they are willing to work, but you have to show them. But so we don't have too much really proficiency in our technician. We have to train them as the show goes on.
Well, now let me, I think answers and explains the situation here. But let me ask you, now as theater workers, do you find the people who are coming to you as actor technicians to be conscientious in terms of professional discipline? Are their work attitudes mature? Is there sincere interest in the show as a whole as you start to work with them? Is this something that they understand and accept at the beginning, or do you have to build a company morale?
The company morale is, we have a turnover of about, I'd say, 50% every year. Now, the ones that were here last year, they know what's expected of them, and of course this, it helps to have this group to set sort of a standard, or to it sort of infiltrates the rest of the crew. I'd say that most of our technicians are more concerned about the show from an acting standpoint, and after. Our biggest scene change is, of course, at the end of scene one. Every person that's on the technical crew is involved in getting scene one struck, because it's a huge center stage setting that has several pieces, and each piece has to be manned by two or three different people.
George, let me interrupt a moment till the machinery is by. It really was a bulldozer, Linda. George, if you can remember the point you were going to make concerned with the scene shift at the end of Act One, which utilized the whole company, they put you on the spot to try to pick up a trend of thought 5 minutes later, but we'll see.
Well, you were talking about morale, and this is a good example of how morale is important. This has become a real challenge to see how fast we can get this scene one scene change out of the way. So everyone puts in a little extra effort to the huge center stage in, say, 30-35 seconds. So we've gotten down that short time already. This is the only time that every member is involved at the same time. The rest of the technical jobs are between scenes, and involving only two or three or four people at the most. So the big scene change, of course, is scene one.
We've been talking to George McKinney, technical director of Under These Hills. George, before we leave Linda to transcribe this, is there anything that you would like to add in terms of the intensification required moving outdoors as opposed to indoor production?
Well,
I suppose we could say that about the only way to really understand it is to try it. Certainly the amplification of all the work is, as you have brought out in the past few moments, of all the technical work is tremendously important. Is there anything you would like to add in terms of improved training of the people that come to you? Although I understand from what you said that you are generally taking young actors and working them into technical people. Do you think that all those studying acting should be required to have some technical proficiency too? That is, in terms of those who may have pretensions toward outdoor drama?
I think this whole experience at Cherokee and with the other outdoor drama that I worked with, the Lost Colony, is a good reason to suggest that people who are interested in acting should have a well-rounded background in all phases of theater, including technical. Of course, their primary reason for taking on technical chores and these dramas is of course money. They get their pay is augmented by being technical assistants. But I think to really be proficient and to make the most contribution to the production, that a person should be proficient in all areas of theater. And this is a very good example of why it is important, if you are an actor, to be able to be a good technician too.
Well, essentially you are suggesting then a greater variety of theater educational experience for the young person than he apparently is presently getting.
That's right.
In other words, more jacks of all trades and fewer specialists.
That's right.
We've been talking to George McKinney. That's the end of interview one, Cherokee, July. I don't even know what year
14.
It is. July 14, 1966. Linda, we're talking to Foster Fitzsimmons, Cherokee, July 14th, 1966. By the way, you may edit out all the hells and dams unless they are just absolutely essential to the sense of what's being said. Foster, first, I wanted to ask, if I get my machine set up here, I wanted to ask first, what do you feel to be the specific advantages of working in the outdoor situation such as here at Cherokee? I know that in addition to working on the Cherokee show, you've done several others, and certainly add that information in, although our questions are basically in terms of what's being done and how you've designed the use of space and so on at Cherokee. So first question is, what do you think are the greatest advantages of working outdoors?
Well, the greatest advantages for me as a worker in the theater is that this particular situation, the outdoor theater, is highly simplified. Makes the performer and the one who's doing in that theater strip all the non-essentials off and get down to the big, simple, sincere, honest, fundamental gesture of the theater. And no matter what terms, verbal, vocal, physical, otherwise, because nothing else carries, nothing else makes any difference. The indoor performer who can use a lot of subtleties, and it doesn't mean that this theater cannot be subtle, but it has to be subtle on a grand scale. And this seems obvious from the very architectural space that's involved, that your audience, particularly in this theater, is sometimes sitting as much as 1,000 feet from you. Or the closest person to you is a good 50 feet away. And this imposes upon the performer the direct honesty of statement, because he has only one chance. None of it is an extended thing. It's just a small, as the kind of theater that we're in, particularly this kind of theater, well, particularly this kind of play, not this kind of theater, is episodic. Everything is taken at a peak. the peak things that are being shown, and everything has to be shown in those terms.
Well, Foster, does this quality of, well, clean action and action that is magnified, when it isn't clean, are the errors projected in the same way? Do you have problems, in other words, cleaning up errors that have been magnified?
No, strangely enough, that most of the errors are small things in terms of stature. Now, small things this way. But the error is that it doesn't project. It becomes muddy, the outline becomes fuzzy, because there are too many non-essential gestures, too many non-essential movements being used. Or even stillness, for instance, is a great virtue in this theater at times. Because what you've got to do, as we do in all real live theater, is to focus the audience's attention. And when you have a canvas this big, where they are looking is terribly important. Who is speaking, for instance? Who's saying that line, that significant line? Who is doing that significant action? Many times we found that the actor is not even being looked at because he's not doing in proportion what he should be doing at that point. I don't know whether this answered your question in that sense. I maybe got aside from it.
To a major sense, yes. One of the things in terms of the dance, which is a considerable feature of the storytelling process in this drama, I have noticed, as I mentioned earlier, that a great deal of freedom has been used in a number of the other shows in choreographing the dances. Now, when I say freedom, I mean essentially motion freedom that is not really rooted, other than maybe for its costuming, in the actual historical source of the dance. I speak of Indian dancers and the mountain folk dancers. They have gotten away from it into a theatrical musical comedy dance that doesn't fit. But here at this play, all of the dancing it seems to me to be thoroughly authentic as to the feel of the Indians. It's a very subtle thing, and I'm sure, having done it, that I must put a finger on some sore point somewhere here. Do you read me at all?
Yes, I do. I hope I do, and I appreciate what you said in this sense, because part of it is expediency in the best sense. And part of it is my own particular feeling about it. Now, the dances in this show, contrary to those, say, for instance, in The Lost Colony, are not as specifically storytelling dances as The Lost Colony, because a lot of times, at least it used to be, I don't know how it is now, these were, when at a certain point, then the dance would carry the story forward. The two places that dances are particular, well, four places in this production, they are what I like to call decorative interruptions. They do not advance the story, they simply intensify the condition at that point.
They're environmental, in
yes.
A sense.
The point is that it's gay or it's ceremonious at this point. It's underlining that, emphasizing that particular aspect of it. It doesn't actually advance the story any. It simply serves to emphasize the setting. For instance, the wedding dance in Nine is simply a folk dance, but it's simply heightening the emotional feeling of gaiety at that time. It doesn't tell any particular story except the exuberance of the people who are in that place. The opening dance is even more a scenery dance to set the place, give it a place in time, and a ceremonious aspect of the whole opening of this, the ritual feeling of the opening of this whole production. Now, as far as authenticity, I have to confess that I know no more than any other man knows how the Cherokees danced in the 16th century. But I know that man hasn't changed the way he does certain things so radically. And as a choreographer, I have certain unique impositions made upon me by the unique aspects of this theater. Of all the theaters that I have worked in and visited, outdoor theaters particularly, this has the most Greek feel because of the steep, in other words, everybody, remember the audience is sitting in a balcony.
The steep rise.
And therefore you had added another dimension that we don't have much in the theater. We have the theater is three-dimensional. I mean, we see a person on the stage in three dimensions, not flat. It's not like the image on a film or a screen. But this has, we now, every member of the audience sees the up and down sideways dimension as well as the back and forward dimension, you see, just the thickness. He sees the floor pattern. So then the pattern on the stage floor becomes very important and gives another aspect, another thing for me to work in as well as the director. It is very difficult to upstage anybody in this theater. You can't. You can't cover anybody in this theater because we're looking down. We can see the one standing upstage as well as we can see the one standing downstage. No one is covering anybody, imposing themselves between their image between the audience and another actor. So there you have this kind of freedom, which makes a visual design in plane, P-L-A-N-E, that you do not have very often in other theaters, except from balcony. At the same time, it doesn't give a very vertical feeling about it, because you're looking down. Great virtuosic leaps mean nothing. You can leap 7 feet and it's still, you could be, or you can leap 2 inches and it has almost the same effect in this theater.
Upstage, in terms of visual response, upstage in this almost means upstage. You're moving into a different plane in terms of the sight of the audience, which gives you that.
Yes, but the downstage man and the upstage man have equal importance.
Have equal value.
Yeah.
And so I meant upstage in the sense of a tilted stage.
Yes. Well, this is not very tilted, but the audience is so tilted that it makes
that
everybody...
you get the same effect.
Yeah,
there.
Right.
It's almost like having, if I understand you correctly, it's almost like having levels to work on. In terms of the design as seen from the audience, but in this case it is the audience that's tilted and not
the stage.
The stage,
right. Now, for instance, in as a different kind of stage, for instance, one down to Lost Colony, where the stage actually wraps around much more deeply than this stage here.
Almost 180 degrees, yes.
Around the side, in which the audience sometimes is looking not only sidewise, but up, you see, from where they're sitting. The incline is much gentler on that slope. So this makes another kind of thing that the choreographer and the director can work with or have work against him. Either way you want to look at it, you always use these things, hopefully, that they work for you. If you do your job right, they work for you, not against you.
That's a qualified comment if I ever heard it. Foster, one of the things we're concerned about in this survey are suggestions for improving training for young people who would try outdoor drama. As you know, a great explosion in outdoor drama hopes, I'll use that word hopefully again, all over the country is taking place. But it is apparently a slightly different kind of production situation. And what suggestions would you have just off the top of your head in terms of false or undeveloped places you see in the students who come to you where we might suggest to instructors this needs development or variety and this needs development. The student is not getting all he should get if he wants to work in outdoor drama.
Well, off the top of my head and also off the bottom of my head, if I may use such a term, with the experience I have had in auditioning and seeing a number of people and is a well, let me see how I'm going to put it. It's not going to be off the top or the bottom of my head in a way. Is a misconception of what is demanded by the situation. Most of all, I see that the young auditioner who's never been out of doors before misses that most important thing that we're all looking for in the theater is an essential vitality. Now, this is cliched, I know, and we're looking for it not only in the outdoor theater, but the indoor theater implicitly. But the outdoor theater, just because of its dimensions, and no matter how small this is, doesn't make this an 800-seater, it still has a different requirement of the actor to his vocal equipment. This is immediately what the actor finds out, that he cannot be heard. This is echoed in the way to project the vocal, he has to have a good strong body as well as good vocal equipment. Just the voice box itself, the throat, the diaphragm. These are all moving. If you watch an actor up close in this performance of this particular play, the whole body is working, sweatingly working, simply to project the tone at any time. The diaphragms are working like bellows to get 1,000 feet away to be heard. I hear many very fine voices which audition very well, but then in the first week of having to do this over and over again, break down. I understand that many of them we have had in the past, someone who particularly is here to watch the voices when they're being misused, the equipment being misused, to take it aside, correct it, the misuse of that. There are several now that I'm very worried about, and Mr. Davis is worried about, even in this, who haven't found out how to place it in this context. Place what they've got. They've got perfectly good organism, but don't know how to use them yet in this way. Most of the time, they abuse them the wrong way. Yell, scream, do all of the bad vocal things that they have been taught, I hopefully think so, in speech classes and speech of any kind of instruction that they've had in speech. And when they get out, and we say, you have to be bigger than that, son or lady, it's got to be a little bit bigger than that, then in their effort and their to make it bigger, they do the wrong thing, which is simply scream or yell.
If I may interrupt just a moment, Linda, we're going to continue this on another tape, so switch to tape 2 to pick up the rest of Mr. Fitzsimmons.